Wonderful the way the Albert Hall manages to shrink to accommodate such chamber music playing. Just the small horseshoe of players and Long Radicals bringing the wind soloists to their feet. Particular mention, I think, of David Flack. Principal Horn is now on his feet, and Stella McCracken, the oboist. Wagner Siegfried Idyll, once described as a series of domestic confidences. Rather prosaic description of a wonderful birthday present for his wife, Cosima. Performed here in the Royal Albert Hall to open their first BBC Prom of 2012, live here on Radio 3, home of the Proms, by members of the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Donald Runicles. The Idyll originally had another title, Triebschen Idyll, Triebschen being the name of their house on the shores of the lake, with Fiddy, the nickname for their son Siegfried, then just 18 months old, Birdsong and Orange Sunrise. The Orange Sunrise referring to the colour of the wallpaper in Cosima's bedroom. Back comes Donald Runicles. And of course, if you'd like to keep up to date with what people are thinking about the Proms on Twitter, well, at BBC Proms is the place to go. And if you want to keep up to date with tonight's orchestra, at BBC SSO. Principal string players brought to their feet. Works really well, I think, going from the single strings of that original Triebschen performance to a rather larger group. Well, it's an early interval tonight in the Albert Hall, and that's because after it, the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra and Donald Runicles tackle a work that even for Bruckner is on a vast scale. His last completed symphony, The Magnificent Eighth. But for the next 20 minutes, from Scottish music-making to Scottish literature, as we join Rana Mitter for tonight's Proms Plus literary event, recorded earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music, just down the steps from us here at the Royal Albert Hall.
Just a few years ago, the Scottish public was asked to vote for the best Scottish book of all time, and their choice was a novel, Sunset Song by Lewis Grassic Gibbon. First published in 1932, the book tells the story of a Scottish farming community which is shaken to the core by social change and the devastation of the First World War. The book has influenced generations of Scots, including my two guests today, distinguished novelists themselves, Ali Smith and Jackie Kay. Would you please welcome them both here today? Ali, let me start with you. When did you first read Sunset Song, and what did it do to you?
Oh, okay. I was 16, and it was a set text at school. Now, and I had seen the girls and the boys, actually, in the year ahead of me, reading this book, you know, on school trips, on the buses, and inevitably they would be crying. You know, they'd be holding this book, and had a kind of windswept girl on the cover, and they would be holding this book, and, you know, whether they were male or female, they would be in the back of the bus going, oh, oh, and kind of holding the book like they couldn't put it down. And I was like, oh, well, I don't think I'm going to like that book. It looks like it's awfully hard going. You know, it's a bit sentimental. And we got to the year when we were going to read it, and I read it at 16. And I think, I literally think it blew me away. It was, I grew up in Inverness, and it's a northeast book. And we had read books from all over the world before that, Cry the Beloved Country, and we'd read, you know, lots of To Kill a Mockingbird, and then Sunset Song. And Sunset Song is written in a voice that was so close to me that I couldn't believe it, about a girl who was the same age as we were. And this was, it was like a whole door opened into what was possible with books for me.
Not everyone reacts that way, I have to say, to set texts at school, so it's delightful to hear they can have that effect. I mean, Jackie, your reaction to the book, and perhaps you can give us a bit of a flavour of the scene, setting the scene of the book for us.
Well, I didn't get the book at school. We did Cider with Rosie instead. Oh, for me.
Also a fine novel.
Good. Also a wonderful novel, but it was, we didn't get it at school. But I remember reading it around the same age as Ali at 16, and it really making a huge impact on me because of the heroine, Chris Guthrie, who is one of the most spirited women ever to appear in Scottish fiction, I think, anywhere, or in any fiction anywhere, not just Scottish fiction. It's really unusual to find a young woman heroine who's clever, who splits into several multiple selves, who kind of refers to herself sometimes as the English Chris and sometimes as the other Chris, and who is a hard worker, who loves the land, and who has a great feeling for the land, and but a great feeling for books and intellect too. So she completely stole my heart, this character in herself, Chris. And I also had the kind kind of the pleasure of watching Sunset Song when it was on television in 1971 when I was 10. And I just loved the televised version as well. I mean, I kind of completely fell in love with Chris, the character who we're lucky to have here. And I just found the whole book stunning, staggering.
Well, it's funny you should say, actually, there's a connection here because we actually have a special guest in the audience, the actor Vivian Heilbron, who actually played Chris Guthrie, the lead character of the novel, in a BBC television adaptation in 1971. I mean, Vivian, you play this very feisty, very lively character. What were your feelings about Chris?
I just loved her. Like, I think everybody who reads the book falls in love with that extraordinary, complicated, and not always absolutely likable character. There's the steel in Chris, as well as and a kind of way that she can stand back in a very objective way, which can be quite alarming in a person.
Well, Ali, it strikes me that in some ways that spikiness that Vivian's talking about is also part of that landscape that you've related the book to. And I wonder, could you just tell us, it related to the part of Scotland that you grew up in. Could you just set that scene a bit more for us? Tell us about the connection between, the land and the woman.
But first of all, I have to say, it's a bit like having Chris Guthrie actually in the room with us, having Vivian Heilbron here, because it really is extraordinarily exciting. For us, it's actually like having the character here. The spikiness of the North, there's a thing that happens in Gibbon's language which is really, really, really extraordinary, like no other writer that I can think of. The number of things he can do in the layering that he uses with his language. Much of it's written in the second person, and the you in this book is a really complex figure, set of characters, set of voices. So that the youth,
and these voices are a farming community at the beginning of the 20th century.
There's a young girl, she's growing up in a farming community, and the voice slips between the individual and the communal, the individual, and it slips within the turn of a single sentence. So you don't quite know where you are with the person, and every time you think you're fixed, it's shifted. And every time you think you understand something, it gives you the underside. And every time you think you're on the underside, suddenly it's boulevarded you again. And there's something very, skillful about the way that Gibbon manages to talk about both detachment and involvement in this, which is why we fall in love with Chris. Because she makes us love her, and at the same time, we can be outside there too. So, we're in both situations with her all the time.
Well, I really think we have to hear a bit more from the character of Chris, and who better than Vivian Heilbron, who's played her in such a distinguished way, to give us a quick reading. Vivian, I wonder if you might give us an extract from Sunset Song.
So that was Chris and her reading and schooling. Two Chrises there were that fought for her heart and tormented her. You hated the land and the coarse speak of the folk, and learning was brave and fine one day, and the next you'd waken with the peewits crying across the hills, deep and deep, crying in the heart of you and the smell of the earth in your face. Almost you'd cry for that. Beauty of it, and the sweetness of the Scottish land and skies. You saw their faces in firelight, fathers and mothers and the neighbours, before the lamps lit up, tired and kind. Faces dear and close to you, you wanted the words they'd known and used, forgotten in the far-off youngness of their lives. Scots words to tell to your heart, how they wrung it and held it, the toil of their days, and unending their fight. And the next minute, that passed from you. You were English, back in the English word, so sharp and clean and true. For a while. Till they slid so smooth from your throat, you knew they would never say anything that was worth the saying at all.
A wonderful extract there. And Jackie, it reminds us that the novel is about many things. It's about the landscape, it's about the characters, but it's also about identity, and it's about what being Scottish is and what it isn't. Do you think that the novel actually, in a sense, defines itself against a variety of things, against the English, against the church, who also turn up in a not necessarily very friendly way in the book?
Well, I don't think of the novel as setting itself necessarily against the English. I think of it as setting its own terms, and I think that passage is a great illustration of that. The language itself, the language that the whole book is written in is a character, and you become immersed in the language, but you also become immersed in the landscape, and the landscape and the language are a song. They are the sunset song, and they're together, and it becomes its own self, and there are lots of characters. There's lots of things that the book examines and has a good laugh at: the kirk and hypocrisy of ministers, violence of men, the coming of machines, the changing of the times. It's a kind of a wry commentary on the time this is dealing with, but it also makes you laugh a lot. It makes you laugh out loud in several places, and it makes you frightened for the character. And the whole book's structured really like a great piece of music, which is why it's kind of fitting that we should be talking about it right in the middle of this prom, because it's a celebration of children and birth and land. Don't you think, Ali?
Yeah, I do. I also think it's a book that's absolutely about musical modulation in voice and tone and register, so that when Chris says that thing about he loved the Scottish words and how could the English words be any good, and then she thinks, no, the clarity of the English words, she's drawn to the clarity. The thing about Gibbon is he loves both. He loves the Scots sense of things, he loves the English sense of things, and there's a point at which he makes a marriage between them in this book that I don't think any other writer's ever done. He finds a lyrical force, which is at the same time the opposite of lyrical. You know, at the same time goes absolutely to the real. And he makes a hybrid language from Scots and English in a way that isn't the same as Braid Scots, you know, but is absolutely literary conscious. It comes from the same project that McDermott and Edwin Muir and Neil Gann and the writers at the beginning of the century were engaged in, which was...
And this is the Scottish Renaissance.
We now call it the Scottish Literary Renaissance. It's not the only one. There's been that last century, there was a few Scottish Literary Renaissance last century, but this one Gibbon is at the centre of, and he finds a force, a form, which is a force in itself.
But Ali, does that mean that there's a sense of artificiality about the language? I don't necessarily mean that in a bad way, but I'm thinking of novels like, I don't know, The Great Gatsby might be an example of something where you're very conscious of the style. I mean, as a Scots reader, do you find that?
No, that's the thing that Gibbon does, because he's, at all points, this is a high literary style. Lyrical so that you can hardly bear it. You read Gibbon and you almost can't bear it. It's almost too much. And at the same time, because he keeps everything so close to the earth, so close to the land, so close to the way that people really speak, so close to the way that people think, and to the way that your heart beats. There's something about language in here which is about breathing. And so the sentences are so long and so kind of allow themselves to go beyond your normal breath that actually it makes your heart feel differently. So he goes direct to the source of your heart, and at the same time, he's doing this highly thing.
And there's something else that he's doing as well, Jackie, which almost goes without saying, but we have to say it. He is a man writing a woman's experience. And he's written actually very effectively about childbirth in the novel. Perhaps listeners will be relieved that we're not going to read that part right now. But there is another reading I wonder if you'd give us that expresses perhaps in a more quiet way how he manages to capture a particular type of woman's emotional experience.
Yeah, sure, and I particularly love this, as Vivian was saying. She is a really interesting heroine, Chris Guthrie, because she's so complex. She's likable sometimes and not so likable other times, and she coolly looks at herself. And this scene, I think, is one of the most unusual scenes to come across in a novel written by a man for its time. It truly is quite extraordinary. But it was only for a second she thought of that daftly, then laughed at herself, cool and trim and trig, and closed the window, shutting out the smells of the night, and slowly took off her clothes, looking at herself in the long glass that had once stood in Mother's room. She was growing up limber and sweet, not bonny, perhaps. Her cheekbones were over high and her nose over short for that, but her eyes clear and deep and brown, brown, deep and clear as a Denburn flow, and her hair was red and brown by turns, spun fine as a spider's web, wild, wonderful hair. So she saw herself and gave her teeth, and her teeth clean cut and even, a white gleam in that grave brown stillness of face John Guthrie's blood had bequeathed to her. And below face and neck, now her clothes were off, was a glimmer of shoulders and breast, and there her skin was like satin. It tickled her, touching herself. Below the tilt of her left breast was a dimple. She saw it and bent to look at it. and the moonlight ran down her back. So queer the moonlight, she felt the running of that beam along her back. And she straightened as the moonlight grew and looked at the rest of herself and thought herself sweet and cool and fit for that lover who would someday come and kiss her and hold her so.
Jackie, something that I find almost impossible to believe when you read such a beautifully composed passage as that is that he wrote the entire novel in 6 weeks.
I know, it just seems absolutely incredible, kind of amazing, because he managed, it's such an achievement, this novel, in so many ways.
But what does that mean to you? I mean, you're a novelist yourself, you know, you're not just a reader, you're a writer. I mean, what does that achievement make you feel?
Envy. Pure and simple. I'm hoping to do it myself in a couple of weeks' time. No, I mean, it just seems an incredible achievement, because he writes about work in a way that's interesting, and in a way that we don't really get now in contemporary novels, this examination of the fields and the work and this hard, hard, back-breaking work, and yet this love of the land that's so close to you at times, it feels part of your own flesh, and then this very feisty, independent, knowledgeable, scholarly heroine, and then the war coming, and then the Kirk and the hypocrisy of the Kirk. So he manages to take the whole community in and sweep us up in this voice, and every so often it feels like a dance step, doesn't it? The way that it moves forward and kind of escapes melodrama by moving back and telling you about something that's happened after it's happened.
It's the first book in a trilogy, the Scots Quair, A Scots Quair it's called, and it's a trilogy which starts with this almost unbearable, adolescent, burgeoning, nostalgic, elegiac, and deeply spiky beginning, and then goes on and hardens and hardens and hardens through into the 30s. And he wrote the whole Quair in 2.5 years or something, given he was 30 years old, roughly, when he wrote this book.
And then died tragically young, of course.
And died very young, and he's written 17 books. I mean, it's as if he was an energy force, and then he just, you know, he really just... performed and then went, you know. People thought at the first that this Lewis Cressit Gibbon might actually be a woman. There was a question about whether or not a woman had written this book and how a man could have possibly written this book. But that's what this book's about. At every point when you think something's fixed, to use one of his words, upjumbles you. It outcome, you know. He says at some point, you think you understand that, you know, you give a label to something, and then as soon as you look again, that label's changed, and the person has undone the package you've put them in, and you know the possibilities have changed because every time humans outdo category, and that's really, I think, what this book's about.
One of the other things that the book does is to move us from the particularities of one farm, one couple, a small community, to actually world-shattering events, because in the last third of the book, the Great War, the First World War, bursts in, and it does that to devastating effect. Is that something that would have had particular resonance with the generation that was reading it first?
Oh, are you kidding? Absolutely. This is 1932. The force of this book, but not just the force of the presence of the war in it, but the force of the presence in a lyrical form, and in a form which is both lyrical and poisoned, so that when you look at it's not quite the end of the book because there's a little epilogue at the end, but at the very end of Chris's part, the real Chris part of the story, as one of the characters comes back from the dead, as it were, there's this moment where something utterly romantic is held at the same time, as something utterly barbaric and ruined and bloody and bloodied. And how Gibbon holds both these things is how this book has force. He holds the lyrical and the real in the one hand and makes a kind of force of these two things. And after the war, what were you going to do? All the feelings you had and also the realities of it. That's what this book's about.
I mean, Jackie, there's also, it seems to me, a sense of disillusionment, simply because in the 1930s, when the book's published, Scotland, like the rest of Britain, of course, was going through the Great Depression. There's a feeling of a generation that had been betrayed. And one can in some ways read that back into the moral ambiguity at the end of the book. I mean, without wanting to give away too much of the plot, various of the characters do things, whether it's related to domestic violence, frankly, or behaviour in war, that make them quite ambiguous characters.
Yeah, so I think that's the other thing that I think is wonderful about Sunset Song, because he's not looking at people in a kind of one-dimensional way. Everybody in the book is complex. The interesting thing is the land is changing all the time, progress is coming, the machines are changing, and therefore the characters are changing all the time in the same kind of pace.
And Ali, even the landscape in the book seems to reflect that feeling of an end of an era, a watershed, you know, an elegiac feeling. There's particularly one scene where trees are described on the estate in a, you know, really very, very impressive and moving way. And I wonder if you might read that for us.
Che went round all Kinradi on his leave that time and found changes enough to open his eyes. Maybe he was fell wearied with the front folk, thought there was nothing on there but their pleatering and fighting. And the first change he saw the first morning did Che, lying down in his bed for the pleasure of it and Kirsty at the making of his breakfast. And Che sat up in his bed to reach for his pipe when he looked from the window and he gave a great roar and he louped from his bed in his sark so that Kirsty came running and crying, "What is't? Is't a wound?" But she found Che standing by the window then, cursing himself black in the face he was, and he asked, "How long had this been going on?" So Mistress Strachan looked out the way he looked, and she saw it was only the long bit wood that ran by the Peasy's Knap that vexed him. It was nearly down the whole stretch of it now. It made a guy difference to the lookout, faith, but fine for Kinradi the woodmen had been. They'd lodged at the Knap and paid high for their board. But Che cried out, "To hell with their board, the bastards, they're ruining my land, do you hear?" And he pulled on his trousers and boots and would have fair run over the park and been at them, but Kirsty caught at his sark and held him back and cried, "Have you fair gone mad with the killing of Germans?" And he asked her, hadn't she got eyes in her head, the fool, not telling him before that the wood was cut? It would lay the whole Knap open to the northeast now and was fair the end of a living here.
Ali, it's a mark of a great novel, and this is clearly a great novel, that it is not confined within national boundaries. At the same time, we are living at the moment through a period when Scotland is looking at its own identity, and that's as true in culture as it is in everything else. Yeah. What do you think the continuing significance of Sunset Song is for Scotland today?
Scotland today and Sunset Song and Grassit Gibbon, it's all very... it's very close to what Grassit Gibbon was where he was politically when he was writing this book. There was a great weight on him to be a Scottish nationalist. There was a great weight on him to be a diffusionist. There was a great weight on this book to be a Marxist text. There was a great weight on Chris to be the land. There's a great weight on Chris to be Scotland herself. The book trails symbolisms after it like a lot of tin cans. Actually, this book outdoes all the trailing and all the symbolisms and all the isms, every ism there is. At every point, Gibbon dodges the ism, because when it comes down to it, he wants us to be human. Not even humanist, but human. And at every point when you come up against something where you think that there's a belief being forced at you or there's politics that, you know, that you're supposed to be listening to with an agenda, Gibbon outdoes it, makes it human, reminds you that there's a heartbeat in here.
And I think that the sun is going to have to set on our particular song at that moment. Oh. We've had a wonderful journey, so please do thank my guests today, Ali Smith and Jackie Kay.
Rana Misser presented this evening's Proms Plus literary event, and the producer was Laura Thomas. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall from me, Martin Handley, for the second part of tonight's BBC Prom, live, of course, here on Radio 3, home of the Proms. The BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra is making its first visit of the 2012 season with its chief conductor, Donald Runnicles, performing works which, for him, are very much at the heart of his musical world. In the first half, it was Wagner. Now we hear from his disciple, Bruckner. He was 63 when he completed his 8th symphony and sent it to his supporter, the conductor, Hermann Levy. He, though, just couldn't grasp the symphony's scale, and he said it was unperformable. That devastated the always totally insecure composer, who spent the next 3 years revising it, changing the orchestration and rewriting the music from small details to whole sections. The whole piece is made up of what you might call symphonic waves, the accumulation of increasingly powerful climaxes, the very opening which starts hesitatingly before arching upwards and then falling away, demonstrates in miniature the musical tension and resolution of the whole piece. The scherzo comes second and contrasts swirling, implacable music with rest and tranquility. The vast slow movement seems to float timelessly, alternately searching and contemplative, one of Bruckner's very greatest pieces of writing. And the finale eventually brings it all together with complete inevitability in a moment of pure musical splendour. When I talked to Donald Ranicles after this morning's rehearsal, I asked him whether he agreed that in Bruckner's great symphonies, you cover centuries of music in one go.
When I'm working with the orchestra, I do evoke Monteverdi, Bach, even further. I mean, the music that was so seminal to Anton Bruckner, the religious music, we're talking about Vittoria, we're talking about Lassus, Palestrina. The spectres of these composers are still very much within this work, and for me it's extremely rewarding, even when it comes to phrasing or the actual orchestral sonority, just by mentioning sometimes these composers, because this was very much where Anton Bruckner came. I mean, his supreme command of counterpoint was through weeks, months of studying all, whether it was Bach, whether it was etc. So, yes, I do think in this vast and epic journey, he invokes and evokes many other composers of a bygone era. And I think that's what for me is so rewarding and what is so fulfilling about performing this music. And this is music that is very much not of our time, in the sense that everybody's in a hurry. It's hustle bustle. And for me, this music is like some luxurious massage, and that sounds terribly glib, but somehow it brings your pulse down, everything slows down, you have fun in reflecting. And one talks about needing patience to listen to Anton Bruckner, but in a way I think people back then listened to music in a very different way than we do today. With this symphony, he perfected the finale. I feel he has absolutely got this right. And it's a phenomenal journey, but I do think that just the dimensions of those movements are perfect.
Donald Ranicles, who was also talking to me about Bruckner the organist and how the orchestra is like having a fabulous 8-manual organ with a 64-foot pedal. Ranicles himself is an organist. He often used to deputise for his father in an Edinburgh church. He does say that Bruckner's life in the organ loft certainly infuses this piece. And he thinks of the pacing, letting the sound in the cathedral, the ideal Royal Albert Hall, have time to clear between each section. And, of course, Bruckner gave one of the opening recitals on the organ towering above us here in the hall back in 1871. So, in a way, his spirit resides in this hall. Ahead of us, hearing his 8th symphony, here comes Donald Ranicles onto the platform, joining the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra to perform Bruckner's 8th symphony.